You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, in the physics news roundup, FQXI launches a new grant round and shifty neutrinos sweep the awards.
This is really the first thing that directly contradicts the standard model of particle physics.
A solar system-sized experiment puts time to the test.
So you transmit radar and you do a double slit experiment to the two moons of Jupiter, two of the moons that are equidistant. Then we bounce radar off them and get an interference pattern back.
Safeguarding the future of humanity.
An existential risk is one that would involve either the extinction of Earth-originating intelligent life or the permanent and drastic destruction of our future potential. In other words, an existential catastrophe is one that would destroy all future.
And Brains from Thunderbirds explains quantum physics.
He's Brendan Foster.
And she's Zia Morali.
Welcome to the latest podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute.
First up, we want to give you money. FQXI is giving away $2 million in our latest large grant round. Let me give you a clue about the topic. Zia, if our podcast is playing in a forest and nobody is there to hear it, does it make a sound?
Are you suggesting that nobody listens to these podcasts, Brendan?
Oh, no. It's a hypothetical, a thought experiment. Imagine if the FQXI podcast is playing in a forest and there's nobody there.
Well, then how did the podcast get there?
What? Someone was having a picnic in the forest and they dropped their phone in the forest.
And the person who dropped it didn't hear it playing and just left it? This seems very unlikely.
Yeah, well, just forget it. This topic of the latest FQXI large grant round is physics of the observer. Right, so if there is no podcast observer, would it still make a sound?
Sounds odd.
Anyway, physics of the observer. To quote from the grant announcement, the development of physics in the 20th century led to a peculiar sort of polarization in thinking about the observer. Prior to quantum mechanics, an observer was largely seen as irrelevant. Physics was about objective reality, observer independent. Quantum mechanics directly contradicts this view and requires a much more nuanced understanding of the observation process and what an observer is. So we ask you to ask questions like, what does being an observer mean? What sort of physical system has the properties required to be an observer? And are there any interesting questions to which the answers depend on how we think about observers? Many more possibilities exist. For more details, please go to the website fqxi.org.
And the deadline for initial applications is the 20th of January 2016. Now, what other big announcements were made in physics over the past few weeks?
Well, only slightly less exciting than the launch of the new FQXI large grant was the announcement in October of the Nobel Prize in Physics, which went to Takaki Kajita and Art McDonald, who showed that the ghostly elementary particles called neutrinos can change identities, or flavors, as we call them, as the neutrinos travel. This shifting had confused physicists who thought that neutrinos were just disappearing when actually they were changing form. Kajita's team discovered that neutrinos from the atmosphere switched between two identities on their way to the Super Kamiokande detector in Japan, while McDonald's team showed that the neutrinos from the sun were not disappearing on their way to Earth by capturing them with their different identities when they arrived at the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory in Canada.
After the Nobel announcement was made, I called up Katie Mack, an astrophysicist at Melbourne University in Australia, who has worked at Super Kamiokande in the past. This is what she had to say about why the discovery that neutrinos switch flavors is so important.
I mean, the main thing the neutrino flavor change tells us is that neutrinos have mass, because they can't change flavors if they don't have different masses. And they can't have different masses if their masses are all zero. And the big thing about that is that the standard model of particle physics, which is the sort of incredibly successful model and includes the Higgs boson, the standard model of particle physics in its basic form, but doesn't include neutrino mass. In the standard model, neutrinos are massless. And so this is really the first thing that directly contradicts the standard model of particle physics. And we've known about it for a while. And the neutrino mass discovery was or sort of solidified in 1998. So, you know, this isn't exactly new, but it's the first thing that says, you know, we really do need to revise this model. We need to go beyond our sort of basic understanding of particle physics. So that's, I think, a big significant aspect of it. It was certainly exciting. And I do remember when this was all happening because I was just getting involved in neutrino physics at the time myself. And so I remember hearing about this new discovery and jumping into the field. And it was a time of great excitement.
One of Mac's research areas is dark matter, trying to work out where most of the mass of the universe is hiding. As she pointed out, the neutrino results also have implications for the hunt for this invisible substance.
So another thing about neutrinos is that because neutrinos do have mass, and because they only interact via the weak force, they are technically dark matter. I mean, they're not the dark matter. We know that at least the kind of neutrinos that we've been able to detect, they can't constitute, you know, the 85% of the mass of the universe that we can't see. But they are technically weakly interacting massive particles, so they are a component of dark matter. And they're the only ones we've been able to detect and identify. So as a dark matter physicist, I think that's kind of a nice thing about neutrinos. They're proof that it is possible for a weakly interacting massive particle to be out there and have properties that are similar to what we expect the dark matter particle to have.
Another interesting point that Mac made was these discoveries built on the work of a huge number of people involved in the experiments, and that it's a shame that the Nobel Prizes only acknowledge, at most, three researchers in their science categories.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's hard with big experiments like this because, you know, there are hundreds or thousands of people who work to make these experiments happen. I mean, you talk about Super Kamiokande, that's a massive experiment. I used to work on that a little bit. It's always a little bit of a shame to just give the prize to the leadership when there's so many other people involved in an experiment.
That was Katie Mack. We should say that Zia spoke with her a couple of weeks ago. Since then, the Breakthrough Prize in Physics was awarded for the same neutrino finding. But the Breakthrough Prize of $3 million will be shared between 1,300 physicists across five neutrino experiments.
So what do you think, Brendan? Which is the better way to go? The Nobels remain a highly exclusive club, but in rigidly sticking to awarding only three people or less for each science award, they often snub people who have made significant contributions. On the other hand, the breakthrough prizes seem fairer in acknowledging the contributions of everyone involved, but that dilutes out each prize and maybe loses them some prestige. Which do you think is better?
Well,
putting you on the spot there a bit, Brendan.
With all due respect to the people who do win the prizes, who deserve the recognition they get, I think it's ridiculous that you don't acknowledge everyone involved, at least as much as possible. I mean, there's not just the many students and postdocs and other researchers, there's the administrative staff, the technical staff, the IT department, the people who install the air conditioning to keep the computers from overheating. And all these people are doing things which are crucial to these experiments actually getting done. And to give the award to single out individual person, typically a white person and almost always a male, just because their name is at the top of the grant, just to me is against the spirit of science.
Oh, well, so quite strong feelings there, I guess. I mean, not sitting on the fence there at all. Ridiculous to give it to one person. But you made an interesting point there. So I actually interviewed Arthur MacDonald for a story for Nature about the breakthrough prizes and how they kind of contrast with the Nobel Prizes. And one point he made was that the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, which he worked at, it's an underground experiment and it's 10 stories deep. So it was an enormous engineering task just to even remove that amount of rock from under the ground before the experiment even began.
And, you know, Dr. MacDonald obviously had an important role to play, but there are so many other roles, too, that are being played that deserve credit.
I agree with you, and I agree with Katie that it is important to acknowledge everybody involved with these experiments. And it is a shame when you see something like, you know, the Nobel Prizes, where they stick so rigidly to the rules, or actually, I don't even think they have a hard and fast rule, but they seem to have this sort of fashion or trend where they've decided to only give the science prizes to at most three people. And you do see some horrific snubs happening year after year where, you know, people who've made significant contributions don't get a mention. Having said that, I mean, you know, it is very nice to see a lot of people acknowledged with the breakthrough prizes. But when you're giving prizes to thousands of people, I don't know, it seems like maybe it does diminish the prizes slightly if everybody's getting a prize. But, you know, maybe there's some middle ground there between just giving a handful of people a prize and just, you know, giving everybody in physics a prize, but I don't know. Anyway, I'm linking to that story that I wrote for Nature addressing the contrasting styles of the Nobels and the Breakthrough Prize on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
Now, on to another style clash, but on a much more fundamental level. What is the true nature of time? Einstein's theory of gravity, general relativity, tells us that time is stitched together with space to create a four-dimensional space-time fabric. It's dynamic, and it curves and bends around matter. Quantum mechanics, on the other hand, tells us that time is much more in line with our everyday experience. Just ticks away at a steady rate in the background, unaffected by what matter does.
So which of these conceptions of time is correct? To put time to the test, Lawrence Doyle of the SETI Institute is taking a standard tabletop quantum experiment and scaling it up to the size of the solar system, as he explained to reporter John Farrell.
Physicists attempting to develop a grand unified theory of everything have long known that the major roadblock is the fundamental irreconcilability of general relativity and quantum physics. But what if it turns out that time is a major key to resolving the impasse? That's the question that Dr. Lawrence Doyle, astronomer and principal investigator at the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California, hopes to answer. He and his team plan to repeat one of the most famous quantum experiments, the double slit experiment, on a scale never before achieved, the solar system. Doyle's intention is to carry out a variation of the double slit experiment, first proposed by the late Princeton physicist John Archibald Wheeler. I spoke to him via Skype about this project and what initially got him interested in the fundamental question of time as it relates to general relativity and quantum physics.
The big kahuna is, why has general relativity and quantum physics, why have they resisted unification for 20 years in Einstein's career and 50 years since? And it could be that we're dealing with two different kinds of time. One is built on, in three dimensions, basically quantum assumes flat time, but it is uncertain, and you can manipulate the time by stretching the probability distribution of time in which a photon can arrive. Does that probability distribution stretch in four dimensions, which is what relativity is about? Relativity is definite, four-dimensional, and subject to mass, time dilation. And so if uncertainty time can erase relativistic time, we've got a handle on a unification possibility. I leave it to the theorists. But if it doesn't, and I kind of lean toward it not them not being the same kinds of time, then at least we'd know, and we could try to unify on the basis of assuming the two times are equal.
How does one go about testing whether quantum time is different from relativistic time? By bringing gravity into the double slit experiment, the classic experiment that shows that light is both a wave and a particle.
Yeah, basically, you shine a light through a hole and it makes a dot on the screen. And you can stop the light down to one, to the electricity, to the laser, down to about one photon a second, say. And you see one pixel lighting up on your screen a second. So you go to bed and you wake up the next day and you've formed a spot. Well, then you open two holes, which is the double slit experiment, and you shine a light and you get an interference pattern instead of two spots. And this reason is because light is a wave. But oddly enough, if you stop the laser down now to one photon a second and you do the experiment again, you might expect two spots to occur. Instead, what builds up when you come back in the morning, an interference pattern is built up. Now you can see each pixel lighting up one at a time, and you go away and you come back, you get an interference pattern, and yet you've only detected one photon at a time. So what's odd about this is that the photon, each photon had to go through both slits. So you're thinking, well, that's pretty interesting. That means light is a wave until it hits the detector. And so mainstream Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics basically says that light doesn't exist as a particle until it's measured.
The challenge now becomes how to imagine this experiment at a planetary scale.
But picture a double slit experiment, but instead of the slits, you have mirrors. And then picture that the mirrors are spherical. They're like little ball bearings. And then you get them going at an appreciable fraction so that the laser you're bouncing off them is Doppler shifted. And then you have a fringe that comes and goes and zooms across your detector in about a millisecond. And then you begin to go, okay, now scale this up to the solar system, and you begin to get an idea. This is a moving double slit experiment where things are flying all over the place. So that's what makes it tough in execution.
So what is the role, then, of the uncertainty principle in the experiment?
Our new thing is we're using the uncertainty principle to erase knowledge of which path the light took, and thereby manipulating the interference pattern coming and going. And then now, what if instead of mirrors, you stick a mini black hole there? So the mini black hole bends space so that the light is delayed along this path again. But this time it's delayed due to gravitational stretching of space-time. The extra length is stretched, is dilated space-time. And you do the experiment over and you narrow the bandpass here, and the interference pattern comes back. Oh, you've covered up the mini black hole. And if it doesn't go away, if the interference pattern doesn't come back, then the uncertainty principle didn't even see space-time. Space-time goes, I don't care, I warp space-time. You can fiddle with the uncertainty principle all you want. I'm out of that realm.
Since, sadly, Doyle does not have the use of a mini black hole, the next best thing is to use the sun.
And the basic idea here is to use a radar transmitted from Goldstone and detected at our detector at SETI, but also we're going to use the Very Large Array. So you transmit radar and you do a double slit experiment to the two moons of Jupiter, two of the moons that are equidistant. Let's just say they become equidistant and we freeze them that way. Then we bounce radar off them and get an interference pattern back. Then we say to ourselves, okay, let's let them move a little so they're not equidistant anymore. Now we narrow the bandpass at the detector, at our radio telescope array. By narrowing the bandpass, we've increased the precision with which we see the energy interval. We know the energy interval better. So we know the time interval worse. And when the energy interval is squeezed down to the point where the time interval exceeds the difference in the separation of the two moons, we get an interference pattern back. So we can use the uncertainty principle at the detector to make the light travel both paths 45 minutes after it made the trip. But that's not our main goal. Our main goal is that by narrowing the band path, we can make the interference pattern last longer. So we do that experiment and we manipulate the band pass and we recover the interference pattern for a few more seconds, and then it goes away as the two moons pass each other, and we have to wait for another conjunction. So we do that experiment several times until we're real comfortable with that, and we're demonstrating John Wheeler's experiment. We're actually performing it and changing something that happened 45 minutes ago. But then, as Jupiter gets close to the sun, the two moons are equidistant, but they're not really, because one of the moons is closer to the sun than the other one. So now we have a delay time. Even though the two moons are geometrically equidistant, we have an extra delay time along this moon's path due to bent space-time. So we then narrow the bandpass at Earth and recover the interference pattern or not. If we recover the interference pattern, that means that the uncertainty time interval, which is a probability distribution in three dimensions, can actually erase knowledge of warp space-time, which is four-dimensional and warped. So in other words, that shows if we get an interference pattern back, relativistic time and quantum uncertainty time are the same kinds of time. If we narrow the bandpass so that we should have recovered even the extra bent space-time interval, and it doesn't, we don't get an interference pattern, that means that general relativistic time is fundamentally different than quantum uncertainty time.
If it turns out an interference pattern is lost after the signals pass by the sun, this provides support for the belief that general relativity cannot be reconciled with quantum physics.
But I would say my prediction would be that there are going to be two different kinds of time, and we're going to have another name for time assigned to one or the other. And to try and unify them will be more difficult. But just the more, at first I thought, well, this may turn out to be of course, the same kinds of time. Well, okay, now you can build on it. Now we know. And I thought that would be the less interesting and more probable. But since I've been reading up on loop quantum gravity and things like that, I don't think they're going to be the same kinds of time. And that would explain a lot why unification has not been possible.
Thank you to Lawrence Doyle for explaining his planned experiment to John Farrell. On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you can read more about the project in an article by reporter Stephen Ashley.
Now, unfortunately, Doyle won't be able to carry out his experiment until the planets align in the right place. So we'll have to wait for over a year for that. I guess we just have to be patient.
And hope that the world doesn't end in the meantime.
You're even more pessimistic than usual today, Brendan.
Well, you know, I always think to myself, we could be destroyed at any moment by an asteroid impact or a supervolcano or a piece of space rock that just comes from nowhere. Or humanity could inadvertently engineer its own demise if artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, or synthetic biology get out of hand. The chances of such catastrophes may seem small, but a good number of researchers from many disciplines are seriously working on these issues. Reporter Corinne Pikema visited the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford University and asked Director Nick Bostrom just how worried we should be about existential risk.
There have been many catastrophes in human history, of course, wars and pandemics and earthquakes, and none of those has been an existential catastrophe. They have been only local and or temporary. In a sense, they have been mere ripples on the great pond of humanity. Global population wasn't significantly affected by any of these past disasters. Maybe the Black Death would make a small dent in the world population graph, but an existential catastrophe is sort of different in kind. It's the end of the human story.
Nick Bostrom is one of a growing number of researchers from a wide variety of backgrounds who are trying to spur humanity, especially scientists and governments, into thinking about the potentially harmful consequences of our ever-advancing technological capabilities. What will happen to humanity once we can create machine intelligence that matches our own, or even surpasses it? Would we be able to keep up with superintelligent machines by enhancing our cognitive abilities? And what if technological advances created with good intent are used for destructive purposes by those who seek dominance over others? These questions seem of ultimate importance, yet until recently, few have been willing to ask them.
An existential risk is one that would involve either the extinction of Earth-originating intelligent life, or the permanent and drastic destruction of our future potential. In other words, an existential catastrophe is one that would destroy all future. The largest threats are anthropogenic, that is, arising out of human activity in one way or another. There are also existential risks from nature, meteors and supervolcanoes and so forth. But the human species has survived those risks from nature for 100,000 years. So they're probably not going to do us in within the next 100 years, let's say. Whereas I do think in this century, we will be introducing entirely new kinds of phenomena and powers into the world that could pose X risk. And in particular, certain future technologies that we will invent, machine intelligence among them, but maybe also synthetic biology, nanotechnology, maybe other technologies we haven't yet thought of. Maybe also technologies that could make it easier for despotism to grab and retain power.
Until relatively recently, there had been little consideration for the potentially harmful side effects of our technological advancements. However, in the past decade or so, great strides have been made to allow this field of research to grow. There are now a number of institutes across the world where researchers are dedicated to understanding threats to human existence and to raise awareness of these with scientists and governments, as well as with the wider population. One of these institutes is the Future of Humanity Institute at the Oxford Martin School at the University of Oxford in the UK. Its director is Nick Bostrom. The task ahead for its researchers is not straightforward, though. Bostrom explains why.
There is no learning from experience, like we go extinct once and then next time, no. So there will only ever have been either like zero or one existential catastrophe. So it's hard to study by just taking some sort of simple, direct statistical approach where you measure the number of these events in the past. You have to approach them in a different way. So I think a lot of the big existential risks will arise from future technological breakthroughs that will arrive. So then you can try to understand what precisely are those technological capabilities that could most technologies could not pose an existential risk. There's a small subset where this might happen. Try to understand exactly how that could come to pass, and then comes the tricky part, which is to try to figure out what is it that we could do in the world today that would reduce the risk of this happening in the future. It looks like there are certain technical problems that can be worked on today, having to do with how you would control a super intelligent agent. Where there's foundational work that can be done today in advance of actually having a super intelligence, but that might increase and be helpful, increase the chances of things going well if and when somebody actually figures out how to develop super intelligence. In other areas, like synthetic biology, it's maybe harder to see exactly what the levers are that you could pull on. And you would worry, for example, that by being very detailed and specific about exactly where the risks are, you might inadvertently increase the risks by kind of creating a blueprint for would-be evildoers. So it gets very complicated.
Threats to humanity could come from many different directions. Biology, chemistry, engineering, neuroscience, to name but a few. Bostrom, who is himself a theoretical physicist, philosopher, and computational neuroscientist, therefore relies heavily on having staff with a wide range of backgrounds.
In the Future of Humanity Institute, we have mathematicians, philosophers, and scientists, and working quite closely together. Interdisciplinary work is hard to achieve on command. I think it happens when there is a natural need for it, if you have the right people in vicinity of one another. And I think it also helps if the people involved individually have some understanding of the various disciplines that need to be combined. We find ourselves forced often to grasp around in the toolbox to see if there is some particular tool that is useful for the particular question we're interested in. So we have to be kind of eclectic. Sometimes when you're in a field where there is as yet no scientific discipline, you're in a kind of pre-paradigm phase of investigation where a lot of the early work just consists of trying to figure out exactly what are the right questions to ask, what are the concepts that enable you to formulate those questions, like what are the key distinctions, how can you break the big confused problem down into smaller sub-problems that you can then do actual research on. Right now we are continuing with a significant push on AI safety research.
Although most of us carry around cheap gadgets that can already outwit the finest chess players ever known, such machines are currently limited to single domains. That chess app can't draw a face, write its name, or tell a joke like most five-year-olds can. Nonetheless, our drive for ever smarter machines puts us on a path towards technology that could, in the foreseeable future, overtake our own cognitive abilities.
Superintelligence would be an extremely powerful thing. Potentially the first superintelligence could be in a position to shape the future according to its preferences. And I think you would see basically with superintelligence a telescoping of the future, that all of those technological advances that we could imagine we are humans achieving in the fullness of time, if we had like 100,000 more years to work on physics and chemistry and electrical engineering and all these other things, we could probably achieve a lot of stuff. you know, maybe cures for aging, space colonization, clean energy, and a lot of other cool technologies. But with superintelligence, all of those things might come about very quickly, like within weeks or years, just because you now have the research being done at digital timescales by superintelligent researcher rather than by human minds. And so superintelligence is not just one more cool little gadget or fascinating technology. It's really a new stage, the most important event in all of human history. The main concern is not deliberately destructive uses, but like accidental things going wrong when you develop a form of intelligence that's greater than human intelligence. You can think about how the rise of our species has impacted other species that existed before us, like the Neanderthals. And you realize that intelligence is a very powerful thing, and creating something that is more intelligent than the human species, like even just prima facie, before looking at the details, just seems like the kind of thing that one should be careful about.
So even though the potential risks are clear, what to do about them is far from obvious.
Ideally, I guess we should develop artificial intelligence only after we have made really sure we have solved the control problem, and then we would live happily ever after. But the world is not like one coordinated actor. It's in a lot of different research groups making incremental progress. And the more relevant question is, I think, what can you as an individual, or we as a small group, do on the margin that will improve the odds? And there, I don't think that working to accelerate or decelerate AI development in general is a very high leverage intervention. It's just hard to make much difference there for a small group. You would get a lot of enemies if you tried to, say, reduce funding for machine intelligence research.
So how might researchers such as Bostrom and his colleagues be able to make a difference?
One is actually to try to first better understand exactly what the risks are. So there are a lot of things that do not pose any serious existential risks, but that are the focus of major concerns. So separating out the few things that might actually rise to that level, and then better understanding those is like a good first step. But then there are like specific things in specific fields. So with AI, I think there are these research questions that we can tackle right now and try to do some of the foundational work that will then reduce the amount of work that remains to be done when you get the particular architecture that you can focus on. There are also more diffuse things that can have positive indirect effects. If we can build more international collaboration, willingness to compromise and benevolence, I think that will be like a very diffuse, beneficial things. Maybe improved collective wisdom and rationality that enable human societies more easily to sort of aggregate useful information and exert good judgment about what's likely to lead to what and what's important.
And obviously, technology does have the potential to improve us too.
There might be ways to enhance human biological cognition over the coming decades through sort of various things in genetic engineering and such that could make it so that if, say, artificial intelligence is invented by the end of this century, it might be quite a different cast of people than people like us who are actually doing it. It might be more competent, a brand of humanity at that point, who will be doing the research. So those would be some examples of interventions that would seem to be existential risk reducing.
Their deconstruction of the potentially catastrophic problems that humanity could face is already leading to tangible outcomes. Bostrom is keen to ensure that their findings reach beyond the walls of their institute to influence frontline decision makers.
We do a lot of media and such because there's a lot of public interest in these areas. We have some interactions with policy makers and cabinet office, but perhaps the more important communication is directly via key AI researchers to try to build up awareness of what the issues would be when you actually succeed in creating artificial intelligence and to try to collaborate to work out in advance how you would ensure that that would be safe. And it might be that in this case, the direct interactions with these researchers in the field will be more important than any sort of general awareness-raising activity.
As the powers that we wield with our advanced technology increase, then so does the importance of thinking about how we are using them and where we are headed. Bostrom and his colleagues around the globe are helping to legitimize the quietly radical idea that such existential questions can and should be analyzed seriously. For someone whose day job involves thinking about disasters in the future, Bostrom is nihilistic, but also optimistic.
Well, I think that every year the end of the world is getting closer. But, I mean, I also think there is this enormous, and maybe more probable than not, enormous upside potential where we reach safely the machine intelligence era and then colonize all the accessible parts of the universe and have some kind of intergalactic civilization lasting for billions of years, where we have digital minds, the size of planets or whatever, thinking thoughts and experiencing forms of well-being that are literally beyond our comprehension. If it becomes possible for humanity to be more reflective about where we're going and clear-sighted a bit where there are maybe pitfalls, then that could be the most cost-effective thing that has ever been done.
That was Nick Bostrom speaking with Corinne Pickema. On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, there's also a link to Corinne's article profiling Bostrom for our sister website run by the Future of Life Institute. I think it's officially our sister, as we share two parents with FLI, FQXI directors Max Tegmark and Anthony Aguirre.
And if you enjoyed that, then you may also like the winning essays from our 2014 contest, which asked, how should humanity steer the future? There's a link to a compilation volume of these essays published by Springer on the podcast page too.
That's actually the third volume in an FQXI series. Our other titles are Questioning the Foundations of Physics and It From Bit or Bit From It. I'm sure any of them would make a great present for the holiday season. You know, in case you're wondering about gifts for the physics fan in your life.
Another book you might want to add to that list, especially if you are a fan of 1960s British sci-fi puppet shows, that is Thunderbirds, is A Beginner's Guide to the Science of the Subatomic World by particle physicist Ben Still at Queen Mary University in London. Still uses the character of Brains, International Rescue's super smart aerospace engineer, to take readers on a trip through the foundations of reality. So we sent reporter Sophie Hebden to meet up with Still and find out just how well Brains explains quantum physics.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The UK television series Thunderbirds launched 50 years ago last month, in 1965. To commemorate this auspicious anniversary, the TV network ITV has published a series of books written by the best-loved members of the International Rescue Team. The boffin of the outfit, Brains, has written a book to explain the basics of quantum physics. So I went to meet his ghostwriter, Dr. Ben Still, an honorary research fellow at Queen Mary University of London. I met Ben at Leicester Railway Station and began by asking him how he wrote from the marionette's perspective.
Thunderbirds are so iconic, it's got a very unique feel about it, and so I tried to keep that in mind when I was doing it. But also, you know, keeping an idea of where Thunderbirds are based in Tracy Island and using their physical situation for analogies such as the Dole Slit and everything like that, and using, you know, water waves, it was a brilliant location for that.
And what kind of audience were you thinking of as you wrote it?
Well, I was given the brief, science interested adult public, and so because these books, they are trying to aim at people who would have seen Thunderbirds in their childhood. So I think it's turned out really, really nicely. I like the way it looks, I like the way it feels, and I think it's a great kind of pick up, put down book. It's not something that you read from cover to cover. It's definitely something you dip into and out.
It's artistic, I'd say, like, and quite
tactile.
It really makes you want to hold it because it looks so beautiful, and it's got quite a 70s feel to it.
Which is quite cool.
The book is certainly a good history of the discovery of quantum physics, bringing in lots of famous names from Rutherford to Planck to Einstein. If you want to share your love of all things quantum, or you have a Thunderbirds fanatic in your family, this could well be on your Christmas present list this year.
That was Ben Still chatting to Sophie Hebden. There's a link to Brains Explains Quantum Physics on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. Still's an old friend of the podcast and the blog, so I'll also be linking to some of his other outreach projects that we've covered on the site, including a podcast piece on his physics art exhibition Jiggling Atoms and Supersymmetry, an art installation inspired by the Super Cameo Kande neutrino detector, where Still used to work.
Which brings us back to the Nobel and Breakthrough Prizes for Physics we talked about at the top of the podcast. I wonder if Still won a share of the Breakthrough Prize.
That's a good question, Brendan. I don't actually know the answer to that, or indeed whether Katie Mack's work at the Super Cameo Candé makes her eligible for the prize either. Both Still and Mack were interviewed before the announcement was made, but I can check in with them and post an update on the blog. Or if anyone knows, you can tweet us the answer at FQXI, or email us at podcast@fqxi.org.
Also email us if you do happen to listen to the podcast while on a picnic in a forest.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we'll get zero responses to that one, Brendan.
That's all we have time for, so thank you again to Katie Mack, Lawrence Doyle, John Farrell, Nick Bostrom, Corinne Pikema, Ben Still, and Sophie Hebden.
He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morali.
I'm off to Jupiter's moons to test the nature of time.
And I'm going to wallow in regret because I didn't join one of the breakthrough prize-winning neutrino teams when I had the chance.